This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
Golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and we are diving into a very lively discussion. Who makes a better Khan, Montalban or Cumberbatch? Maltal Khan or Cumberbatch, you know?
There you go.
We will acknowledge the Space Seed and the Wrath of Khan are two great storylines, and by and large, more popular among Star Trek fans. But Star Trek Into Darkness is the most successful box office draw in the history of Star Trek films. How about that, Ken?
Yeah, no, that's true, Zach. And we could dive into movie plot lines and gaps and all of that, but we're going to look at the Khans from the perspective of character, screen presence, drive, passion, villainous, if that's a word. Villainous mean that it's a woman? Or how we should say evilness?
Evilness?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Evil? Okay.
Well, regardless, these are controversial topics that generate a lot of feedback. So we will ask, we'll go ahead and put a disclaimer out. We'll ask that we be respectful in our Facebook comments, and this could be a fun conversation, but a lot of people take their Star Trek and their perspectives very seriously, and we should allow for diversity of thought between original and rebooted casts.
I couldn't agree more. So, you ready to kick this off?
Shall we begin?
Okay, we shall. So, let's start off with character. We understand the timelines were the same, right, through the eugenics wars, and Khan was the same in both universes when the Botany Bay left Earth, but the drivers in the two timelines obviously were very different. So, Zach, just to kick things off, what did you see as the similarities and the differences in the two Khans?
Well, if we're looking at just what's canon, right, we ignore things like books and comic books. And, you know, we can, just for the fun of it, we can bring those up later. But for right out of the gate here, I just want to look at what is canonical, what is on screen, right? It's hard to compare these two Khans because we see the Khan we see in Into Darkness, timeline-wise, is the same Khan from Space Seed, you know, around, you know, in the 2250s, 60s. But motivational-wise and all that, he's very much like the Khan we see in the Wrath of Khan from the 2280s. You know, he's revenge-driven because he's been wronged, and he has an injustice that he feels needs to be righted. So that is his motivation. It's weird because Into Darkness is a combination, really, of Space Seed and the Wrath of Khan on several levels, and that informs Khan's character. It would have been a more A to B comparison had, you know, the Enterprise, for example, found Khan in Into Darkness, and then his motivations would have all been the same. He was just picking up where he left off when he left Earth, when he went to suspended animation. He's like, okay, I'm back. I got all my crew here. We're going to continue our crusade for a better future, for a better humanity. Because ultimately, Khan thinks he's doing the right thing. He thinks that he's superior, and that gives him the right to rule over everyone. And it's for their own good because he knows better than them because he's mentally, physically superior. And you know, you get that from Montalban's Khan, and Cumberbatch's Khan. I mean, I don't know. He doesn't have that air of superiority about him. I think if he does, it's less classy than Montalban's. You know, he has that air of arrogance, but it's classy, respectable arrogance. And Cumberbatch, he's a little rough around the edges that way. So it's they're coming at it from very different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I think through most of what I'll stick it. Right in with the Wrath of Khan and Into Darkness and not travel back into Space Seed to kind of, I guess, make it a little bit easier to bring the two together. So what I saw that they had in common, the way Cumberbatch played Khan and the way Montalban played Khan, through very good direction, I think, from both Nicholas Meyer and J.J. Abrams, was for the most part a very controlled passion, a seemingly calm presence, but you could feel that underlying anger and frustration. Or at different points where you thought they were going to lose it, how they kind of pulled it right back. Now, it changes at the end of Into Darkness, where Khan is pretty much in a rage, and similar to where Khan was at the end of The Wrath of Khan, just as he's detonating the Genesis device and the Reliant gets blown up pretty good, and you know he's ticked off too, but yet calm, and that's where I see the similarities in how the character was played. I haven't read anything as to how Cumberbatch prepared for the role, so I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage there. I don't know if he watched the other movies or if he was told to make it his own, that type of thing. But he had a very, very strong presence about him, a very intellectual presence about him. And with Khan, especially in The Wrath of Khan, I didn't have that intellectual presence, even though you knew he was very smart. You had a physical stature, like an imposing type of character. So that was probably the bigger differences, where Cumberbatch was imposing, but he did it through that deep voice and the expressions that he could create, and you could feel like his eyes could burn through you. And Montalban had that to a degree, but he also just had this imposing figure. I mean, he was no joke. He was a big guy. I mean, Montalban was not somebody you wanted to get in an arm wrestling contest with or a push-up contest with. So I kind of see that as where they came together and then where it kind of separated. And it did drive, I think, a lot of the variance in the film just because of how they were portrayed, right? I mean, Khan's uniform and costume was kind of... It was raggedy and it was appropriate. It was just very different. Whereas Cumberbatch, if you think about it from this respect, if you've traveled to England, if you visited the UK, and I was stationed there for a year, so shout out Tony and Tim. Everybody there was always dressed to the nines, right? Even when I was there in '84. Anyway, if you were going to work, it didn't matter what your job was; you were always in a suit. And I one thing I picked up about Cumberbatch was, you know, he had a style about him. It wasn't that much of a costume. It was more of the I guess more of a secret agent, but yet well dressed persona, right? So they had a very different approach to the characters, as far as I could see, anyway.
Yeah, he had some nice coats, didn't he?
He did. And I think that overcoat, right, is kind of a tropish bad guy thing. It's not quite a cape, but it flows like one. So mm-hmm. And he wore just black, right, for the most part. And he played it off well. And, you know, the one thing that he had, I think a little bit better than Ricardo Montalban, was just these piercing eyes. I mean, fiercely piercing eyes. And I think that scene when he's in the brig and turns away and he drops that tear, I just remember the color that was that was captured in that shot, and you just go, man, this is one intense guy. I understand why he's a very popular actor.
Well, that's the scene that got him the role. He auditioned with that scene and sent it into Abrams, and that's when they decided they had their Khan. So the brig scene there where he emotes and sheds his tears. So he has a very interesting face. I use the term interesting because I don't know how else to describe it, but it's memorable. He channels his emotions well through it because you have some actors like, let's pull out the big guns, Star Wars comparison, right? Hayden Christensen. Disappointing performances in the prequel trilogy. I don't think anyone can argue with that. But he is very emotive. You know, I mean, if the Star Wars prequel trilogy was a silent film, we might feel a lot differently about Anakin Skywalker and his performances, because that's only half of it, right? Hayden Christensen looks intimidating, but then he starts talking, and you're like, I don't know, this dialogue, you know, it's a bad combination. But Cumberbatch can take that and then really pull at your emotions, because... You know, for a lot of this film, you're kind of on Khan's side. You're like, yeah, you know what? Marcus did do him wrong. So I want to see him go and get his crew back and get revenge on the bad guys. That's what I'm saying. They're coming at Khan from a very different perspective. And for a lot of the film, I thought, oh man, maybe they're just going to leave Khan a good guy, right? Which is a very well done thing for the film to do, to take the most iconic and memorable Star Trek villain, make him not a hero, but at least a protagonist, an anti-hero for the majority of the film, and have you go along with it and sell you in that way. So. Speaking of Khan's style, even if you go back and look at Spacey, he had some very elaborate, nice looking clothes. So
he did.
that is a through line through the whole character, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think that I agree with you and what you're saying there. I see where you're going in terms of the approach that they took with Cumberbatch, and you're right. He had this presence, right? And let's talk about presence a little bit. The screen presence by both actors was incredible, I think, and it's probably easier to look at the more current film and the way things are made today, and Cumberbatch's popularity, his deep voice and his menacing, to say, oh, he comes off as a very powerful character. But when you watch Wrath of Khan, I mean, he owned that movie. I mean, not only is he in the title of the movie. And I think it was originally The Vengeance of Khan.
Right.
Well, I guess it was Undiscovered Country first. But at any rate, he dominates. I mean, Montalban really took that role, and his presence was, every time he was on screen, it was memorable. The lines he got to utter, we all quote them, right? Revenge is a dish best served cold, or I'll pursue you around the moons of Neva, all those things. And
there she is.
Yes. I mean, there is so much pop culture baked into The Wrath of Khan and the lines that Khan's made. I mean, the biggest line in the movie is Kirk screaming Khan, right? Echoing across. So he had a great screen presence about him from the beginning. I think that the introduction of Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness was more curious, right? He's this background character. He can cure this guy's daughter, and they play the menacing music. But, you're kind of with an eyebrow raised, okay, where are we going with this? And mm-hmm. then his actions are far more powerful and menacing than Khan's. Khan in the Wrath of Khan. It's getting very redundant, isn't it? It's going to be tough to follow this discussion. I'll be careful.
This conversation.
There we go. And I think that that is also a key element that changes the presence. It's you could see on the screen what Khan did in Star Trek Into Darkness, but in Star Trek II, that's an easy way to do it. Khan being on screen, was the key draw, right? It wasn't the action or the stuff that he was driving, because he was on the bridge. He was fairly limited in his mobility. He didn't get into crazy action scenes that Cumberbatch was able to do. So I think both had fantastic screen presence, but very different.
Right. I mean, if you look at the introduction of Montalban's Khan in that movie, just the build-up to it is so suspenseful. Like, he's wearing all this survival gear from City Alpha 5, slowly takes it off piece by piece. The music just crescendos when he takes the headpiece off, and you see him, and even Chekhov's like, Khan! And it's like, oh man, there he is. I compare it to the Joker's reveal in Batman 89. He's in the shadows and he's slowly walking out, and it's building and building and building, and then he steps out of the shadows into the light. He's like, you can call me Joker. It's like, oh man, it's the same kind of idea there. And I find that a more fulfilling screen presence, because you've built somewhere and it pays off, and you're like, oh man, there he is. And throughout the whole film, like you said, you're waiting to cut back to Khan. You want to see what he's up to on the Reliant, what he's doing. And yet, true, we never get to see him do what he does, but you believe, just through the sheer performance of Montalban, you believe this guy can do incredible things. I think the most incredible things we see him do in Star Trek II is he lifts Chekhov up by his spacesuit, and then he lifts that debris off of... I never pronounce this guy's name
Joachim.
Right. Joachim. It's like Joaquin. That's not right.
He says Joaquin. Yeah, Joaquin. Yeah, it should be Joaquin, but that's not what he says. Yeah.
So I mean, those are the only physical feats we see him perform. But more than that, he brags about his superior intellect and how that's the only reason they were able to survive on City Alpha 5. And you can believe that, because that's a crazy situation they were thrown into, and there they are, they're still surviving. So proof there. But, for Cumberbatch, it's not that it's style over substance, because there is some substance there. I'm not going to take all that away.
A lot of substance, I think.
But, there is a lot of flash and style, and you need that in a modern film, right? I think you needed to re-educate people who Khan was and what he could do. And then if you don't want to do that through exposition, but of course, in the 60s, Star Trek didn't have a lot of budget. So they're sitting around the briefing room, they're talking about, oh, Khan did this, Khan did that, they're genetically engineered. Show don't tell. So in Star Trek Into Darkness, we really see him. He takes out a whole squadron of, Klingon troops, and it's very impressive. And that tells you all you need to know about his physical abilities. And then, he was, and as we learned, he was sought out by Marcus because of his mental abilities, because of his mind for war. With those two traits of the character are well established in Into Darkness. And Cumberbatch always has a screen presence to him, and that's a big reason. I think Star Trek does an excellent job whenever they cast their, guest villain of the movie, right? And he's in that proud tradition, I find. And he's not as compelling as Montalban, because you're like, oh man, I want to see more of this guy, but he is as interesting, if not more so.
Yeah, I would say that, and I agree. I think that the action scene in Star Trek Into Darkness, when they're on Kronos and he's kicking ass and taking names, was fun to watch. It really was. And obviously, you're able to exploit the character in a whole new direction when you can take him there, because, they just infused him with, Jedi-like reflexes, right? And I mean, he's not just taking down bad guys; he's taking down ships. I mean, there wasn't much he could not do, and maybe it was a little over the top, but it was fun. What I like about Star Trek II, and what I like about Montalban, is what you pointed out. He lifts Chekhov up, but he's so calm in doing it. And I know if you watch the commentaries for Star Trek II, Nicholas Meyer coached him not to go over the top, because you just come off that more menacing and intimidating the way if you can internalize and just stay cool, right? That, I guess, for some reason that highlights insanity, and it highlights presence and menace, and I never thought of it that way, and I think it was very, very effective. I really do. And so I thought the presence of both Cumberbatch and Montalban made both movies what they were to a large extent. And this is not a discussion of which movie's better. We're just staying on the characters here, and for what they had to do, I think that they both did very, very well.
Yeah, I keep coming back to this Joker comparison, but people say that Khan is Kirk's Joker. I believe there's even an episode of Standard Orbit named that from way back in the day before our time here, Ken. But when you have an iconic performance like Carlo Montalban from the 80s, it's one of the most iconic, not just Star Trek, but film villain roles, And then you have another, have Jack Nicholson playing the Joker in the 80s, an iconic performance, not just in superhero movies, but just in cinema in general. And then you get to, the 2000s here, and people revisit these iconic characters. You have to approach them differently. Heath Ledger's Joker could not be further from Jack Nicholson's Joker, but it's just as valid, just as good, if not better. That's up for another. That's a whole other discussion for a whole other group of people to have. But you have to do it that way, because if you play all the same beats as you played last time, the comparisons are inevitable. But it just it makes it not so feel so retreaded, because if you're gonna revisit a character like that, let's do something different, because we've already seen that. We've already seen what came before, and it was iconic. So let's try something different. That was what was so great about Khan here, because we never got to see him really go to his full superhuman potential. I mean, we saw him and Kirk fight at the end of Space Seed, and if Khan was half the Khan that he was in Into Darkness, he could have wiped the floor with Kirk before Kirk had the opportunity to pull that pipe out and beat him. It's like, man, if he could just taken a few more beats of that pipe, Con, you could have won. But
I thought it was a giant 23rd century space wrench, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, strangely enough, I don't think those things were there in the last episode of the time we saw engineering. I don't know what it was, Ken, but it's pretty convenient.
Oh,
they installed those for just such a situation.
You know, we haven't brought up Schmedlap in a long time, but I think he kind of left that out, right? He didn't put away his tools. I don't know what happened there. That happens sometimes. But, you know, I think one of the things, too, that I neglected to point out is part of the tension and the drama in Into Darkness, or the, you know, the intention anyway, was to keep Khan's identity hidden until that fight. You know, then you start going, oh, wait a minute, right? And then in the brig where he actually announces who he is. And of course, he only announces himself with one name, and which I thought was pretty, you know, again, I'm going to try and stay away from judging the movie because I think there were a lot of gaps in this movie. And that was a problem, this whole Jonathan Harris angle that they took.
John Harrison.
John Harris. What did I say? Jonathan Harris?
Yeah, isn't that the guy who played Dr. Smith on Lost in Space?
Yeah. Da, you're right, John Harrison. Da, you're right. That's right. You do that well. So, you know, so that was a different approach too, where you have this menacing character, but you're not exactly, well, you're not supposed to know who he is. And they really, really tried to keep it under wraps, which, you know, a lot of people said that was a mistake. But
it was.
Anyway, you take a risk, you know, it was a gutsy risk to take, and it backfired on him, unfortunately. But
right.
As did much of the movie, in my opinion.
Well, I think your point here, Ken, is all he needs to say is Khan, and people are like, oh, you're that guy. It'd be if you unfreeze someone from the past and they say, I'm Hitler, right? And that's all they say, right? You immediately know who that is and what they stand for, right?
I guess, but Khan's a pretty common name.
Or was that not your point at all?
No, I'm just saying that there wasn't any point of reference at that situation. There was nothing to hint for Kirk, for Spock, or anybody else that this was a frozen, you know, genetic superior being. There was nothing,
right?
There was, you know, this guy is a terrorist. He blew up the depository
Kelvin
building,
library.
The library, and you know, let's go get this son of a bitch. But there was no mention of any background that would lead you to believe that he was a supervillain, or I guess the only real hint you had was the blood. But even that was a little bit, you know, when he cured that guy's daughter, even that was a little odd, because you didn't really think in the original series that he had incredible healing powers or anything along those lines. I mean, they really did create a quote-unquote Superman versus an enhanced man. Right, and Khan in Star Trek II was an enhanced man. In this one, he was a Superman. He could do just about. He could practically fly. I mean, he could leap tall buildings or tall starships. That's for sure.
That's for sure. You know, you mentioned that. You know, him just saying Khan, right? But hey, that's exactly what Maltabon's Khan did in Space Seed. He's like, "Who are you, Khan? Just Khan, nothing else?" He's like, "Nope, just Khan."
Yes.
But then he's trying to keep his identity a secret.
That's
which
right.
Which is the irony with Cumberbatch takes the same approach when he's trying to, quote-unquote, reveal who he is. A little more information would be helpful. But, you know, it was a stretch enough to believe that Cumberbatch was the same character that Maltabon played just due to their physical appearance. So if you have Benedict Cumberbatch saying, "My name is Kong Noonien Singh," I don't think people would have gone along for the ride there. That would have required much more exposition, which does exist, by the way, in the comic book tie-in. If you want me to talk about that at all, Ken.
Yeah, so. Please. Fill me in.
Well, so in IDW does a great job with all the Star Trek comic books. I think they're great, and they tie into the movies, and, you know, they're as close to canon as you get because, you know, several of the same writers, well, you know, Orci oversees them, and they have a stamp of canon, but not, you know, in its own way. It's pretty much canon until the movie's contradicted. There already have been some contradictions, but I like to see these because people want to say, oh, I like the movies and all, but I wish we could see that, you know, the regular adventures, the 5-year mission on the Enterprise, and this new crew. Well, that's what these comic books are. And a lot of them are, well, earlier anyway, a lot of them were remakes and retellings of original series stories, like Where No Man Has Gone Before, Return of the Archons, Trouble with Tribbles, you know, new twists on those old stories. And that's cool, too. But it's been a healthy balance of new stories and old stories retold. But for Into Darkness, for a tie-in, after the film came out, they came out with a miniseries called Khan, similar to their miniseries of Nero after Star Trek IX came out. And this chronicles, you know, the history of Khan. But the framing device is Khan is on trial after the big crash in San Francisco and before the coda to the film, where they're, you know, rechristening the Enterprise, and we see Khan in his cryotube. So he's on trial here. And it's interesting that the many points are raised that, look, we have no records of this time because of the eugenics wars. Everything was a mess. So they're completely dependent on what Khan has to say about himself. And they even mention that, like, throughout, like, Spock and Kirk talk about it throughout the comic book series or miniseries. They're like, well, can we even believe what this guy is saying? And it's very self-serving, and, you know, they question it as well. So it leaves that ambiguity that, okay, maybe this is true, maybe it's not. Maybe this guy isn't even Khan. Maybe he's just using that name. He has no physical resemblance to the original Khan, you know, because they bring that up, because they show a picture of, you know, Montalban's Khan, like, this is Khan Noonien Singh, who are you, sir? Yeah, so part of the explanation, and I recommend everybody check it out, just called Khan, Star Trek Khan, so check it out from IDW. It's a great miniseries. If you're a Star Trek fan, you'll enjoy not just this, but any IDW comic. But sales pitch aside, what they do here is they explain how Khan went from Montalban to Cumberbatch, basically. We get a lot of the same history that we're familiar with from the original series and other books, like The Rise and Fall of Khan Noonien Singh, the Eugenics Wars books that Greg Cox wrote a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So we touch on all that stuff, and then ultimately we find that when Marcus's team found the Botany Bay, they unfroze Khan, they altered him physically so he would not be recognized, and then they actually altered his mind some. They tried to erase his memories. It's one of these classic fiction amnesia things, right? You remember everything, like, that you can do and, like, in all your knowledge, but you forget everything about yourself. It's a, you know, very big fantasy sci-fi trope, right? But ultimately Khan remembers who he is, and that's what kicks off his rebellion against Marcus, right? Because not only had his face been taken away from him, but he'd been ripped of his personality, you know, of who he was and his identity, and then his whole crew had been captured. So that is the catalyst to what causes him to go rogue in the darkness, because, you know, that's something else that was left a little vague, you know, in the original film, like, okay, who found him? Is this what he looked like and all this stuff? So all those questions are answered in this comic book. Okay. So there you have it, folks.
So that was Zach Moore, brought to you by IDW.
Check is in the mail, as I understand it. So
I'm sure it is now. Hey, nice pitch. And we'll definitely send him a copy of this tape. So, that's helpful, because I did read the tie-in to the 09 version, the prequel, I guess, as you would call it.
Countdown
to... Yeah, and it was okay. You know, it was a little bit out there, but, you know, that doesn't mean I didn't like it. It was just interesting, but not great. But this sounds like there was a lot there to extrapolate. So as we get further into Montalban and we get further into Cumberbatch, I guess my question now is, they both had revenge, but two different motivations, right? You had from Star Trek II, the motivation was Kirk abandoned him and his wife died, and he wants to, he'll do anything to kill Kirk and destroy the Enterprise. And then after that, I guess apparently he's got a starship, he's got a pretty cool device, he's going to wreak havoc in the Federation. So you assume there's quote unquote more to come. And then with the Star Trek Into Darkness, it was revenge for what Marcus did to his crewmates or his family, right? Or the people that he holds most dear.
Your family.
Yes. And in both situations are enough, I think, to create the motivation. Although it does show just to the, I guess, the lengths that Khan would go in Star Trek Into Darkness by blowing up Section 31's headquarters, right, and killing a lot of innocent people. It was not even a, nope, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to wreak havoc because, and he did believe that his crewmates were killed, right? That was the impression. He didn't realize they were just hidden in a torpedo, which...
Well, who would?
Not me. There's lots of places I would hide. That wouldn't be in the top 10. But at any rate, so it you know, I do understand that he's coming from that aspect of 71 other people are dead. And they were his brothers and sisters, and they were all co-rulers of the world at one time. And so he is going to come after Harris and destroy everything that he holds dear.
Marcus.
What did I say? Harris again? Marcus. RoboCop. Everything right. That RoboCop holds dear. And Buckaroo,
dead or alive, you're coming with me, Khan.
That's right. Buckaroo Banzai does not win this one. But I do think that the motivations were equally powerful, and I think that technology in what they were driving in the more recent movie allowed Khan to really exploit, you know, scale and scope of revenge, where Khan, you know, in Star Trek II, he kills Spock, right? Or in a sense, causes his death. And that's why he was... If the series ended with Star Trek II, or if Leonard Nimoy's career with Star Trek ended with that movie, that villain would be the all-time leading villain in all movie history, I think.
Well, you say that, Ken.
In Star Trek history.
Let's remember who killed Captain Kirk. It was Dr. Tolian Soran, played by Malcolm McDowell.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Never happened.
Soran is actually a pretty interesting character, but he killed Captain Kirk, and no one remembers him outside of Trekdom. So,
I don't think comparing generations to T'Wok is a good idea in this conversation. Because I have, you know...
But you see what I mean, though.
I do, and that's why I say what I say. Because, Dr. Tolian is an afterthought. He was not a great villain, and his quest to go back into this ribbon, it was such a far-fetched story. It was just really hard to get your arms around. And the drama in how Kirk died... was not played up well at all, and so there's a big difference there, I think, because the other piece of it was they really were turning over. Star Trek was changing over, right? They were turning over to generations. When Spock died in Star Trek II, Star Trek was just finding its feet again. It was just getting its sea legs. It came off a movie that did well, but wasn't successful with critics, and it was slow paced. They make a great movie. And I think Star Trek would have continued on without Leonard Nimoy or, you know, him directing and all that other stuff. It would not have been as good, but it would have continued on.
Well, yeah, it definitely could have. And they were even trying to set it up that way, planning that Leonard Nimoy was going to leave. I mean, that was the whole impetus of him coming back, was to have, for him to have that great death scene. He would leave. You're building up new characters like Savick to clearly be the Spock 2.0. Right. David Marcus is coming on, you know, so we have our, you know, next generation, so to speak, of characters coming in. You have this trainee crew. So they were setting things up to phase out the older cast. I mean, even looking back at the motion picture, you got characters like Ilea and Decker that trace back to phase two with the same mindset of, okay, we got the new cast, the old cast, we'll right. mix these and we'll phase out the old guy. So no, I see what you're saying. And yes, if Leonard Nimoy had never come back, I guess what you're saying, that Khan would be more remembered as the guy that killed Spock.
Because it was such a powerful scene. It really was. And, you know, I remember seeing Star Trek II in the movie theaters over and over again. And you know, well, there's a pretty good show that Norm and I did where we compared The Wrath of Khan and the motion picture and why I like the motion picture more, but it's for very different reasons. But that scene in The Wrath of Khan was very, very powerful. And there's not a lot of movies where you go into the theater and, you know, maybe there's some rom-coms and things like that, or some dramas where you see people cry. But when you're a Star Trek fan, and let me tell you, the fandom back then, when Star Trek was coming back, you know, the conventions you see today don't compare to the ones I went to. I mean, 20, 30,000 people at conventions back then was the norm, okay? Mm. It was a different world. And when they took that character, because Star Trek was a much smaller universe away from us, it rocked. It rocked the world. I mean, people were really upset and crying. And I know there were also death threats that, you know, because Roddenberry was trying to submarine the whole plot and put it out there that he would die and all this other stuff and yada, yada. So that it kind of took away. And that's why they flipped that scene to the beginning.
Well, were you fooled? Us. Yeah, I was going to say, were you fooled by the fact that they killed off the crew the first scene? You think, oh, well, that must have been it. I guess we're safe.
Huh? I was relieved for a while. But when the situation came up where, you know, before he went running down to engineering and they realized they couldn't get away, I went, oh, he really is going to die. Right? It did hit me. And I do remember that as a kid thinking, oh, maybe he won't. And then being, uh-oh. And I
just find that just an extremely clever way to go about it. You know, like, oh, let's kill him off at the beginning and then we're back on track and here we are, and then you subconsciously like, oh, we're good, and then it just hits you again, even though you go in the knowledge of, oh, maybe Spock's gonna die, you think you already saw it, and then when it comes back, you're like, oh, they did it, oh my gosh, that would be such an incredible thing to see, because, you know, in this day and age, you're that's never gonna be replicated. You know, stuff's gonna be spoiled, stuff, they're gonna promote stuff like that these days. You know, that's the magic of the movies is, you know, some of it, look, movies are still great to go to, but some of that magic is lost, unfortunately, in this day and age, I feel.
So. Yeah, I agree, and if we take it back to Into Darkness, they were trying to do that with Khan. Right?
Oh, look at you, Ken. Well done, sir, bringing it back.
They really were. They were trying to keep that all a secret and surprise the audience. And you know, the thought process, people were going to go, yeah, it's Khan, you know. And instead, people went, yeah, we got it, you know. Or there was a lot of leaks just before the movie.
Well, Abrams has even admitted, you know, hindsight is 2020, but he's admitted that, oh yeah, we probably just should have said it's Khan, because you could have built off that, the name recognition. But, you know, hey, that's what we're here to talk about, the name recognition of Khan, the character, right? So
that's right.
If we're talking about the motivation of the two of them, I think, you know, Cumberbatch is Khan. He does a lot more damage, right? But his motivation is a lot more understandable. Like, obviously, I don't agree with either of these guys' quest for vengeance, but of the two of them, he was literally wronged by Marcus in Section 31, right? I mean, they woke him up, they had him work for him, they held his family, his crew hostage, and then, as far as he knew, killed them all off, right? So, yeah, if I have a mind for vengeance, I would be the same way as Khan. Like, I'm coming after Marcus, I'm coming after him hard, I'm taking away everything that he loves, right? But then you look at Montalban's Khan, and Kirk had nothing to do with the fact that City Alpha 6 exploded. And everything was laid waste, right? And he had nothing to do with that. And he had nothing to do with the death of Khan's wife or his people or anything like that. It was purely just projecting all of the bad stuff that had happened to Khan. Yes, Kirk put him on City Alpha 5. And that's where it ends, right? I mean, that's where his responsibility ends.
And never
ends.
Bothered to check on his progress.
Well, you know, I always...
No, I just remember that line was a good line, you know, because that helped you understand where he was coming from. As silly as that... thought, and I wouldn't say silly, but it's an odd thing where Space Seed ends, and it's like, wouldn't it be interesting to come back and see what civilization evolved from all of this, right? And instead, Khan is like, well, it's been 15 years. It's not that long, but it must have felt like an eternity.
If they had never made The Wrath of Khan, that would have been an excellent Next Generation episode to follow upon, right? Like, you know, because that's what we do now. We cross the streams, right? But
we do. Yes.
80 years later... You know, like you go to City Alpha 5 and you see this, you know, society that has been built up, you know, from the crop that has sprung from the seed we planted here today. So it's interesting. That episode ends with such optimistic promise. Then, like, boom, reality hits you in the face, right? But that is not Kirk's fault. I always interpreted it, though, that Kirk never told anybody about any of that. Like, that was completely off the books, right? Like, because that was my just fanon. I'm sure in one of these novels or books, they explain that probably, but that's my interpretation of it, that's the why nobody went and checked or anything like that, because it was all off the books. What do you think, Ken?
I think space is very big, and they were left on a nondescript planet in the middle of nowhere, and they were forgotten about. I'm sure it was in all the captain's logs. In a sense, though, Chekhov wasn't in that series, and Koenig tells a great story as to how he wound up being in the movie and knowing who Khan was. You know, I kind of took it the same way, that when they went to what they thought was City Alpha 5? City Alpha 6.
They thought they were going to 6.
Because they were going to 6, they wound up at 5. But when they were going to 6, you know, it would have been appropriate if it had been Sulu or Uhura as the executive officer and mentioning something. You know, it's like, I haven't been to this system since we dropped off these characters from Earth who were frozen, and tell a story, you know.
But you can't do torture Sulu. You have to do torture Chekhov. That's how it works, Ken.
So. Nobody, hey, you know, Sulu has the oh my and the great, you know, lines and the way he brings it, but nobody screams like Chekhov. Nobody screams like Chekhov.
Oh, man. So all that to say that maybe somebody should have checked on Khan at some point. Sure, I don't think anyone was obligated to. It would have been nice, but you're right. Space is very big. There's only so many starships to go around. This is the early, you know, this is still in the early days of Starfleet, all things considered, big picture-wise. Khan's, you know, anger at Kirk is completely misplaced. You know, as Chekhov says, Captain Kirk was your host. You returned his hospitality by trying to take over his ship and murder him. So I think at the end of the day, Kirk was actually very merciful to Khan, and he forgot that very quickly when you know, the weather turned bad and City Alpha 5 turned to an inhospitable wasteland. Unfortunate turn of events, but his motivation is really whacked out, and you can see that Khan is a broken man, right? He's a broken man. He had these aspirations, right, to better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, right? Mm-hmm. So he thought he was going to build this new society, a world to conquer and all that. And yet it all turned to garbage. And, you know, of course it's going to break him. And then his wife, who he loved passionately, died as well. So he's got nothing to live for except for his hatred to Kirk. I think, you know, that's the thing that probably, even more so than his superior intellect, is the thing that kept him alive all those years. Burning vengeance of, like, if I ever get the opportunity, I'm going to come after Kirk and get him for doing this to us. But still, misplaced, not Kirk's fault. So of the two of them, Cumberbatch has the more reasonable motivation, right?
Yeah, he just takes it to a. I guess you could argue that both of them take it to a level far beyond what you would think would be reasonable, but that's what vengeance does, I guess. Right. I absolutely understood where Khan was coming from the perspective Maltaban was coming from, but from the perspective that you mentioned, that his brain was twisted, right? He's been living in this hell for X amount of years, what he said, 6 months after they were left there. So for 14 and a half years, they've been living in hell, thinking about this every day. And of course, your perspective changes. You know, as people start to die or you lose your wife, the only thing you think about was that guy who put me here. So I get that piece. And then for Cumberbatch's Khan, yeah, it's very clear. I mean, you killed 72 of my brothers and sisters. Oh, you're going to pay, right? And now, he blew up London. He took out San Francisco. I mean, he did a lot of bad things. And at the same time, when it worked to his advantage, you know, he was calm. He was helping Kirk. And I always wondered, if they didn't stun him, would he have been as bad as he was? And the answer to that is yes, he would have been. He would have taken them out anyway, because that's what Prime Spock tells the other Spock. No matter what you think, this guy is, you know, he's going to turn. And
well, that's some bias on Prime Spock, though. You know, I mean, yeah, this Khan has a very different life experience than that Khan. So I don't know. You know,
no,
I mean,
his DNA is, and his everything about him is about being a ruler, you know, unpassioned ambition. This guy is going to rule the world. And
so nature over nurture, then, Ken, is what you're saying.
I think so in this case, because that's...
Well, he's genetically engineered. So.
Well, he is. That's right. And so that's why I say what I say. It would have been another gutsy call, I think, and kind of a cool one if you know, there was some way to end that movie with Khan coming into the fold, right? Like a big change of direction. But, you know, he's the Michael Myers of the 23rd century, man. You can't kill the boogeyman. He is what he is, and you can be as nice to him as you want, but the second he gets the opportunity, he is going to kill you in order to advance his cause.
Right, because ultimately, you know, if they hadn't stunned him, right, he would have taken over the Vengeance, and then if, you know, just to say, for the sake of conversation, they don't talk to Spock Prime, they give Khan his crew back. he thaws him out, and then what, they would probably just rule like over Earth on the Vengeance, right? Take out the Enterprise, and then just take out any ships that came their way. I mean, I see your point there, because these people, I mean, they I hate the nature nurture thing is interesting, but I think you have to throw it out when they're genetically engineered to be this way. So that completely removes that whole great philosophical debate of the ages from the conversation. He just, you know, similar to what happens in Enterprise in A Mirror Darkly, right? Empress Hoshi Sato has the Defiant from the 23rd century future, comes to Earth and just takes over because she has a superior ship, and obviously everybody bends to her will because we have the Terran Empire 100 years later when we get to TOS and Mirror Mirror. So, you know, that would be a very similar series of events with Khan and the Vengeance, because it was obviously much more sophisticated than any other starship that the Federation had. The only reason that it was taken out was because Spock blew up all the torpedoes, you know, inside the ship, which the ship didn't plan on that, having 70 torpedoes to blow up inside it. So even Khan couldn't think of that contingency, right? So.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that the ship survived that. You know what I mean?
Well, barely.
Well, it was intact enough. I mean,
intact enough to crash, yes.
Yeah, but it wasn't like the nacelles got, you know, where it blew up in the center of the secondary hull. You would have think that, you know, the ship would have blown into a bunch of directions, and maybe the saucer section would have survived, which still would have wreaked a lot of damage on San Francisco in theory. But it doesn't matter.
You know, in that situation though, you see before the big torpedo blow up, you get to see the cunningness of Khan, right? He's like, you're a logical man, Mr. Spock, let's discuss this logically. So he plays out like, you do this, and this happens, and this happens, and then boom, you know, I win, regardless of what happens. And that's a side of Khan that, you know, we got to see hints of in Space Seed, but we never got to see after that, because he had been broken and warped and by all his time in City Alpha 5. He was just one-track mind, revenge, right? His crew tries to talk him out of it, you know, like, hey, we have the will to go where we please. Let's do something else. You know, let's not chase Kirk. You know, but he could not escape from that one track mind. And we got to see Khan to his full potential in Into Darkness, because he had not gone through that, you know, crippling situation.
I think that's an excellent point. The Maltoban Khan could be manipulated. Benedict's Khan could not be manipulated. Let's just put it that way. You know, that he was manipulated into doing the things he did under the threat that his family would be killed if he didn't. And then once he thought they were dead and he had nothing to lose, there was no other way you were going to be able to talk him off the ledge. The other Khan, or drive him over the ledge. He was going to take control. That's why he was so calm and so, you know, in Into Darkness, you know, when they're marching him down to sick bay at any time, you know, he just took out all these Klingons. He could have taken out every one of those security guards and wreaked havoc on the Enterprise, but he didn't. He was patient, right? And that's huge for somebody who is hell-bent on revenge and full of anger and has all this strength and ferocity in him. The ability to control it was with him. It was not with Ricardo Maltoban. He could not, I'm laughing at the superior intellect. Right. All right, now I'm going to come kick your ass. You know, I'm done.
such a grade school mentality. Like, you know, what an insult to like calling Marty McFly chicken or something, right? Like, oh, that'll get him. That's what gets caught in the end.
It worked. Yeah.
So the two-dimensional thing, talking about their, you know, different approaches here, the two-dimensional thinking always bothered me.
Okay.
You know, I mean, because it's like, yeah, I get he's from the 20th century, but even then you have planes in the sky. You know what I mean? Like, that's what ended up saving the Enterprise at the end. Well, not saving, but give them a huge advantage over Khan, because he's thinking the way that Star Trek thinks about ships. They're always on the same plane facing each other. You know,
that's right.
That's not how space works, you know?
That's right.
So that's how the Enterprise can come up behind him and take advantage of the three-dimensional thinking of space. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I get the point they were trying to make, but I don't think that was like the killing blow. You know what I'm saying, Ken?
I do. I think that the way they approached it was okay. Just that one line, he's intelligent but not experienced, had them thinking in a different way, right? You know, okay, now we have to think more about the training and the many, many years in space. And yeah, you know, going vertical versus horizontal is pretty simplistic. I give it that. But I think it was a tangible thing, you know. I don't know how they could have played it otherwise. You know, they could have done some kind of spiraling maneuver in space or something, or you know, maneuvered the ship that would have been impractical with big, heavy models, but you could probably do it today. And
right. No, that's an excellent way to tangible thing, a tangible explanation to kind of distill down the tactical disadvantage he's at. So
yeah, they used a simple maneuver to do it, but you understand that there had to be more to it, right? So Z minus 10,000 meters.
Right. Well, you know, and the thing about Montalban's con is he had a equal, if not inferior, ship to the Enterprise, which made his attacks, you know, more impressive that he was able to do that. Meanwhile, Cumberbatch's con had the most advanced ship Starfleet ever created. And like, okay, well, that's easy. You know, it's easy to defeat the Enterprise that way. So, you know, there are definite pros and cons, no pun intended, to the situations that each of them are in.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I didn't think of that dynamic. And I guess I never thought as the Reliant as being an inferior ship. Just a different one, right? I mean, different mission, different, you know, I always thought that the Reliant was probably more, it was funny because the Reliant was, it seemed to be more of a warship, just the way it had its forward and aft torpedo launchers and its roll bar and its phaser banks coming off the ends of the roll bar as well. It just seemed to have more weaponry, but yet it was being used for a very scientific mission, right? So it was fulfilling the Starfleet, mission or drive or you know everything about being an explorer and being
so
scientific.
A humanitarian and peacekeeping armada, Ken.
That's right, baby. And and the Enterprise, yeah, it was getting a new crew, but you know, it's I always like to think of it the way when I view the motion picture that it's sexy, it's the ship of the line, you know, it rocks and all that other stuff, but it was aged and it had a different feel. But I hear where you're going. It might not have been as strong or as advanced as the Enterprise, but it was pretty close, right? It was more compact. I guess you could, it was the Voyager, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
The Voyager was a pretty powerful little ship, but it wasn't the USS Holiday Inn. I mean, Enterprise Day.
I see what you did there. So yeah, so those are the cons there, you know. I guess the ultimate question, the big question here, who was the bigger villain of the two? And you know, if I had to answer this, I would have to say Cumberbatch. It just, you know, from all the things we've discussed, I mean, he created the most collateral damage. Did not seem to care who got in his way for vengeance. I mean, he allowed him more opportunity to, because obviously Montalban's con was in deep space and. You know, he was just his one target was the Enterprise. He went out and sought out that target, and he stuck on that target to the bitter end. Cumberbatch's con had a lot more opportunity to wipe people out along the way, and he did. You know, I mean, he killed Captain Pike. Let's not forget that. You know, Bruce Greenwood's Captain Pike, one of the best parts of the first two Star Trek films in the Kelvin timeline. Kirk's surrogate father figure. You know, we all know Captain Pike from the Prime timeline. He had a tragic end there. It turned into a happy ending, after all. But, you know, he had a tragic accident there, and this mirrors that. You know, this could be seen as the timelines aligning themselves. Who knows? But, you know, the fact that we lost Captain Pike, I mean, that's a gut punch, you know? That was a very powerful moment in Into Darkness, and that's directly, Connor's directly responsible to that.
Excellent points. I don't disagree. I just had the take that the emotional impact because of the timing in the film, right? When Spock died, rocked so many people's worlds in a different direction. Now, in theory, Khan killed Kirk in Into Darkness, but it just didn't play well. And by the time you get to that point to the movie, the impact of Admiral Pike's death has been lost, I think, a bit. It's diluted. That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Because so much more has happened. I see what you mean.
Yeah, cinematically, at the moment that did occur, you're right. That was a great movement, in the film, a very powerful moment. And Abrams does have a knack for that. Even Kirk's birth in the first movie may be one of the most powerful Star Trek moments in any of the movies.
That might be my favorite scene of any Star Trek incarnation, honestly. So.
It really was beautiful and tragic and all and emotional all in once. I mean, you don't get those combinations too often. You know, where
combinations.
Wow, here we go. So, as far as who the bigger villain was, as far as just overall destruction and mayhem and chaos, Cumberbatch, without a doubt. as far as emotional impact, that, like I said, if Star Trek III had gone in a different direction, I think that Khan, if he still isn't the most favorite, most hated villain in all of Star Trek, I don't know who is. You know, I remember for many years after that, and they would compare, Khan versus Krug, said that right. You know, obviously, Captain Klaw was a joke.
well, everybody was like, he's the next Khan. They said that about every villain. Like,
yeah, and I thought
Rafo was the next Khan. Like, no, I don't think so.
No, all due respect
to F. Murray Abraham, but you were no Khan, sir.
Oh, God, no. And General Chang was a great villain, I thought. You know, articulate, cunning, plotting. You know, he was a pretty evil guy, but just not to the level of Star Trek II's Khan, in my opinion. Neither was Nero in 09.
Well, Khan, Montalban's Khan had history with the crew, which is something that no other villain in any other Star Trek movie has had. Right, this is the same character, the same actor who the crew met 15 years ago.
That's right.
Right, so that creates such a tie-in to emotional investment from previous that you don't get with all these people you see in one film, and then they're gone. You know they're going to be gone, right? The guest star villain of the week, right? They're going to be gone at the end of this movie. So if they had chosen to go in a different direction with Cumberbatch's Khan, where he's like, he is, you know, this antagonist, anti-hero, protagonist, anti-hero, and Into Darkness stays there, and we don't really resolve his character yet. Maybe he goes off in space with the Vengeance or something, who knows? And then comes back in 3 or 4, you know, that you have more emotional investment into that character. So, but when they're these one and done villains, they just do not have the same impact. So I think regardless of cinematically, no villain is going to match Maltavon's Khan in the Star Trek universe unless it's somebody that you have a vested interest in already. So that's my take on it.
That's a very fair point. So I guess the answer to the question, in my opinion, is this, that Cumberbatch's Khan was a great villain and created a lot of mayhem, and the death of Pike was huge. It got carried away though when they took out San Francisco in the ship. It was a great plot point, but it was almost like it didn't happen. You know, a year later, and they're talking about the relaunching of the Enterprise, and they're flying the missing man formation. But I'm thinking, didn't he just wipe out tens of thousands of people? At least in theory, he must have. And I thought because there was so much violence and so much of the effects and impact, it kind of got lost in the shuffle. Whereas with Montalban, he had that gut punch of evil by killing the most beloved character in Star Trek, right? And people can argue left and right who was more popular, Kirk or Spock. I would think it would be tough to argue that Leonard Nimoy's Spock wasn't the most beloved character, and it had a very emotional impact on all of us old timers back in the day.
Well, loss is always more profound when it's, you know, specific, you know, and so, you know, Spock dying, specific loss, huge emotional impact. Into Darkness, and you can translate this in the real world, right? Hundreds and thousands of losses. The human mind can't even comprehend that. You can't even compute that. So it becomes a statistic to you. That's yes, right. You say, oh, well, that's terrible. All those people died. And then you go about your business. But like if someone you know and love died, I mean, that wrecks you for
that's right.
days,
that's right.
weeks, you know? And that's what you're getting at. And I agree there. As the viewer, as the audience, as the Star Trek fan, clearly that's the situation that's going to stick with you more and hit you harder. So, you know, There it is.
Great discussion. This was fun.
This was fun. You know what else is fun, Ken? Leaving reviews on iTunes. That's right. So we still have our iTunes review giveaway. So what we're doing is for anyone who leaves an iTunes review for Standard Orbit on the iTunes store, US, UK, any country, just let us know. We're going to give away a Blu-ray of Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1. So leave us a review between now and December 15th, and you'll be entered to a random drawing, and you could own the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation on Blu-ray.
That's right. And Aaron Harvey, as ridiculous as it sounds to you, We're all Star Trek fans, and I did love his note on Facebook about, well, that makes a lot of sense. TNG on a TOS show. I was like, yeah, okay, I know it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It makes sense in context. So.
It'll never make sense, but it's what we have, right? It's what you have, and it's never been opened, and it's real, and it's pretty cool. That's a whole season worth of...
That is 26 episodes plus many special features. I'll tell you what, if you guys have not seen or gotten the Next Generation Blu-rays, they're worth the behind-the-scenes material alone. It's so in-depth, you know, talking about, you know, especially the first season, because it's talking about how we got from the original series and original series movies to starting a brand new era of Star Trek and the Next Generation. You get, you know, archive interviews with Roddenberry, Robert Justman, you know, DC Fontana's in there. So just David Gerrold, all these guys, original series tie-ins, okay, launching Next Generation. So it's great stuff. Hours of bonus material on there. So good.
Yeah, yeah. So... You know, hats off to the team there in Earl Grey, right? We've got
Richard Marquez, Lee Hutchinson,
and we've got Amy Nelson.
Amy Nelson. So yes, right? So we'll be doing our own Star Trek Generations crossover pretty soon. Hopefully, one of us will not die in an unsatisfying way, but you know, who's to say?
So, I just hope they get their chemistry together quick, and that they learn a lot about each other, so that if we do have a Bridgemates 2.0, we smoke them. I mean, absolutely smoke them. But you know, I think it's more than appropriate to wish the three of them the best of luck in their new journey. I know we have been real excited on the network to hear that Earl Grey is back, and by the time this show launches, you guys should be well underway.
Sipping your next cup of Earl Grey.
Sipping your cup of Earl Grey. And we'll be, if you need help or cover or whatever while you're having your coffee or tea breaks, we'll be up in orbit circling, making sure that you're safe.
Well, comparing cons and talking about Star Trek Next Generation are not the only things we've been doing on Trek FM this week. So here's a few things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Don't watch any of the extras on the first disc because they're all duplicated over the second disc. So then that way you can just watch them in order and not have to worry about, oh, well, let me skip this one because I watched it on the first disc and do all that.
Wait, to clarify, they have all the special features in column A on one disc and then all the special features of column A plus column B on a second disc?
That is correct.
That makes no sense to me at all.
I know, I was very confused when I sat down to watch it.
Melodic Treks.
Matter? I barely know her. Oh, it's painful. I don't know. You snowing me?
Painful is just saying Remus and blah, blah. I felt myself falling asleep. I felt like it was my parents were telling me a good night story where you were giving me that track listings there that... like.
Does it still McFly?
That's one of my favorite ones.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Within about 15 seconds, you texted me back, Dr. Giggles, we have to do Dr. Giggles. And my question for you is,
yes,
why did we absolutely have to do Dr. Giggles?
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions, and that's what the 70s were about. Was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek.fm, you can always find us on Trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/Trek.fm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter @Trek.fm, Facebook.com/Trek.fm, and The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.fm and click Discussion on the menu bar.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners. So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, we'd like to thank Renee Roberts, Richard Rutledge, and Aaron Harvey. Thank you so much, always, for your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM network. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701. You can find Richard at rut8972. And you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at geekfilter. So if you're looking for me on the network, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm always on there, pre, post shows, talking different subjects with all our listeners. And you can also find me on Twitter at BostonSCPO. That means Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s. And we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything, really. Love to talk to you guys on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.